Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The United States Border Patrol has exciting and rewarding career opportunities with the nation's largest law enforcement organization. Earn great pay, outstanding federal benefits, and up to $20,000 in recruitment incentives. Learn more online at cbp.gov/career/USBP.
This holiday season, the best deal in wireless can only be found at Mint Mobile. Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile and buy any three-month plan, you'll get another 3 months for free. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order and activate from home with eSIM, while saving tons on phone plans starting at just $15 a month. For a limited time, buy any three-month Mint Mobile plan and get 3 more months free by going to mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/save.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad,
a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news,
we're watching,
fashion trends, pep talks where we give advice,
mental health moments,
and games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
So first of all, Al McKenzie and Peter Kunner, welcome. I just mentioned, Al, to Peter while we were waiting for you to enter, that the connection that I have with the brain is that my ex-boyfriend used to DJ there, Ariel.
Oh, I remember Ariel, yeah.
That's my only connection. I must have gone there, but as I said, I can't remember a sort of 5-year period of my life, like everyone has that sort of phase. I was clubbing in Europe most of the time, so I think I'd put it down to that. Anyhow, let's start. I want to get a little bit about each of your childhood, because I always feel that there's events in the childhood which actually are just very important in life in terms of what gives you drive and where you go with your life. So maybe I can start with you, Peter. Where were you brought up, and can you tell me about what your parents played for music and when your taste diverged from theirs?
This is a very good question, Steve. Thank you. Well, I've always known since a child. I was adopted at birth, so my mum told me that I was an orphan. In fact, she used to sing that Tammy, I think it's a Tammy Wynette song, I'm nobody's child. Nobody's child. You know that song? You wouldn't know that song. It's an old country song. Just like the desert, I am running wild. No mommy's kisses and no mommy's smiles. Nobody loves me. I'm nobody's child.
How did that make you feel?
Well, I think what happens, what I know it's commonality to adoptees is that they turn tricks to ingratiate themselves into the family so that they're not like a cuckoo thrown out of the nest. So there's a people-pleasing element to that. So it puts you on that kind of hungry boxer sort of thing, you know, like you've got drive and stuff. And I always felt like I wanted to do stuff. But I found out later on when I was 24, just as Doreen was breaking through, that I was, I met my natural mother, and I found out from her that she was a singer in a band. My father was the MD, the main trumpet player and guitar player. So it all kind of felt like it was in the blood, if that made any sense. And then, well, my dad was really good. He was a Johnny Cash nut, basically. So my first gig was Johnny Cash when I was 10 years old at the Opry Hall in Belfast. And from that sort of religious moment on, I was brought up in country and indie, sort of Irish folk rock, that kind of stuff. And I was into, our taste diverged once the Police hit the scene, and I was a big fan of theirs and Queen. And I just grew up, and I kept on the indie guitar thing. I had an indie band then from when I was, was 14 or 15. And by the time I was 19, we were in London recording for U2. They had a label called Mother Records. So that's the time I was in London doing that. And then when that didn't work out, I was on friends' floors for a few years, sofa surfing, until I got on my feet, and then I started going clubbing. And that's when I went to the Brain Club.
Okay, we come to that in a minute, because we're jumping like so much there. Just what's fascinating really is this idea of drive, that actually you were adopted, and this sort of feeling gave you your drive. My father, I was told by my mother that my father never wanted me as a third child. And I always think the reason I ended up doing TV was to sort of get love elsewhere, because he didn't love me, you know? So I think the drive factor is really fascinating.
I get that, totally.
So Al, with you, I mean, I'm no therapist, so you can say this is all bullshit, I don't believe it, whatever you want to say, but where were you brought up, and what sort of music was played for you by your parents?
I was brought up in Scotland, in Edinburgh, in the, just slightly younger than Peter, I like to point out all the time. in the 70s, well, 68, I was born. I mean, it's quite usual sort of upbringing, really, just normal, not very musical. I was in sort of council estate in Edinburgh. Father did have a record player and did buy a lot of records, and that was as musical as it got for me, really, when I was young. I mean, he had a wide eclectic taste in music, so I was, that music was a thing, because he brought sort of little 7 inches all the time and stuff, you know, and put them on. But that went from stuff from the Carpenters to Bob Marley and Roxy Music, stuff like that. So it's quite an eclectic thing. But I mean, I never went to a gig or anything like, but unlike Peter taking to Johnny Cash, I went, my first gig was 1985, which I went on my own, like seeing like no cameo. So I sort of forged my own path musically and what I liked, never played an instrument. It's quite strange, actually. And then when I left home around, I'd be about 20-ish, 21, I went to bank instead of, I was going to go to university, but I'd sort of rebelled against my parents, who wanted me to be a doctor. And I decided that that wasn't for me. And I bought a sound system, and for some reason, and bought turntables, started DJing parties. Used to DJ at 18th birthday parties, stuff like that. And that would be around the early 80s. So, mid-80s it'd be, actually. And we moved to England around 84. And then my friend was a DJ I befriended in England. And he just said, go, what's that? Start playing records to people. And he had a hostel radio show, actually. And he used to go there and play. And I just started playing records. And house music came along. And it just hit me massively. And so I just, really early on, so I just started playing house music lots, and then just really mad time.
Just to go back a little bit, that 1985 gig, who was it?
It was Cameo.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Larry Hagman with, when he'd just done Word Up and stuff, so, which was amazing. And then I think the week after I went to see George Clinton. So, it was quite an eye-opener for a young white boy. It's quite interesting. Very interesting, in fact.
Yeah, he had that brilliant codpiece, didn't he?
He did have that brilliant codpiece, and he was wearing it at that gig, yes.
might be the revelation is it's not a card piece.
Because I'm a generation further back, you know, I was born in 1959. And for me, Bowie was, you know, sort of my everything as a teenager. And he represented a world in which I wanted to go in, because it was much more, you know, it was open. It was, you know, open sexually. It was so different to this small village that I was brought up. Was there an artist that either of you had that opened up a sort of different world that you felt that you could belong to instead of the world that you came from? Al, do you want to start?
I remember the first artist I can remember ever really being into, and it was quite late on, it was Prince, to be honest. That was I think just musically, it's diverse. It went, that cross, because I was right into my sort of funk and soul and stuff, but also rock. So he was the one person that just kind of like did it all, basically. And for me, that would be, I mean, to this day still, really, and Prince has always been, I mean, I remember the bands, like, when I was so sick, you know, 10 years on us, so, like, people like Blondie and stuff, I kind of liked, my father quite liked Blondie, but that's him telling me what he liked. I think Prince would be about the first one I really sort of got into. I mean, it was, like, bands like that whole new romantic thing with Duran Duran and stuff, but quite short-lived that. I mean, it's funny, like, Bowie, he used to like Bowie as well, but 10 years on, I suppose. So, you know, but that was all mainly for clothes and stuff for me. I just liked the look, generally, was the thing I liked when he sang. And I suppose more of a scene than bands would be that whole Rude Boy two-tone scene, that, which, well, the sort of four Rude Boy scene, really, with your specials and madness and stuff like that. I loved that, but, you know, I was young, but, you know, certainly I was no Rude Boy, but I used to dress up that way, and I used to love that sort of thing. So that would be the first sort of scene that I was sort of into, I'd say.
And Peter, what about you?
I do remember Eurythmics having a huge impact on me. I was obsessed by Annie Lennox. And I think, like Bowie, that gender indescript, I suppose, and the way they kind of messed it up, and they started, like, you couldn't tell. But that was kind of really sexy back then. I don't know if you recall. And then a lot of girls started emulating that by cutting their hair and dyeing it. So it was a very big thing then. And It's just been very exciting. The power dressing and the voice to go with it, and Sweet Dreams being almost so pseudo sadomasochistic. Not that I knew that's what it was at that stage. I had no idea. But I thought it was just very heady, very exciting. And I suppose later on there was other artists drew me in, like Simple Minds. I was listening to Depeche Mode there on the car on the way home the other day, and Roddy. Is it Roddy Frame from Aztec Camera? And I was listening to Echo and the Bunnymen and Spare Us the Cutter. And I was just like, I was obsessed by these records. But one of the bands that really obsessed me were a band called, they had Party Fears 2, The Associates. I don't know if you remember them. I mean, I'm obsessed with that record. It just draws me in because I know he's got this operatic tone to his voice, and there's something very frail about that record. And I kind of don't want to sit and play it, because I know if I play it, I'll understand it better. And I don't want to understand it. I want it to stay magic.
So, no, his voice is amazing. I'm Billy McKenzie. That Party Fears 2 was my favorite record of all time.
It just sits out to me, heads and shoulders above. And it's a tragedy, because I'm sort of linking up a lot of the lives that these people had, you know, these shimmering flowers. Because I saw this Top of the Pops performance, and I was thinking, quite a lot of them, you know, had issues, or they got hold of stuff that wasn't good for them. And, you know, at Simple Minds, career was wrong-footed, I believe, by drugs, and so was the Associates. You know, it's like, it's sort of, and if you think of what's his name? I can't remember. Big Country. You know, there's so many of them.
Sure, Adamson.
So many. And there, but for the grace of God, go I, Steve.
but the grace of God, go all of us, I reckon, to be honest. Okay, you both mentioned that your parents, Peter, your adopted parents, as it were, and also your parents, Al, were interested in music and bought music and played music in the home. But were they culturally aware, and did they really sort of, if I think of my parents, it was like, you don't get into the arts in inverted commas because it's not a career, you know, it's not something that you should do. How was that for you? Let's start with you again, Peter. Here.
All right, I just like they were incensed when I decided to drop art because I had a good hand and I could fairly draw and I was going to go to art college and be a graphic designer and all this kind of stuff. It's kind of like what I was saying about, you know, you want to go to a bank or be a doctor. So they're like, you know, my mum used to say musicians were two to each penny. So two to the penny, right? You know, why would you do that? And because music's like air, it doesn't pay. And I was going, well, I don't care. I'm just obsessed by this thing. And I don't want to tread the path that's sort of just sitting there in front of me and end up with a mortgage and a house age 21. And then you're in that, you know, in the pipeline, as it were. I'm obsessed with this thing. I don't know what it is. And when I play it, I want to know how to record it and how to make it bigger and how to make record. But I was in a place in you know, where we are in Derry, there was nothing here. I mean, there was no one to even tell you how to use a guitar tuner instead of your ear, right? So talk about having a regional disadvantage. So the time you get to London, you just learn so much more. And I think that was my folks were culturally aware because I know that when they met, it was like Cliff Richards was at the top of the charts with Move It, and they were going out dancing all the time. They were dancing to all those tunes, what's his name? Go Johnny Go by, the names are escaping me here, I'm going too fast. But they were out there and my mum could jive like nobody and she loved partying and stuff like that. So there was music was in the house all the time. All the time. And for me, it was great because although I wasn't making the music they wanted, my dad bought me my first guitar and it was a little Fender Music Man. And I just took to it like a duck to water. Within a year, I could play lead guitar and all the rest of it. And before long, I found a band. And that's how I wanted to experience it. Because when you if you're obsessed by it, in my case, I just want to understand it by playing it and enjoying it and having the feel of it. Because when the band strikes up and you feel that power, there's something that happens that it's like an energy that's beyond most human experience when the band strike up. So that kept me away from throwing stones at the police, Steve. You know what I mean? I had more important things to do. You know, we were chasing girls in glory in the shadow of a war. That's how we were thinking, you know?
So, Al, for you, did they believe that there was a sort of cultural value in the world and that you could actually do something which is of use as what you've both done, which is, you know, enhance the cultural value of what's out there for us?
I don't think my parents had any sort of cultural awareness at all, to be honest. I think, you know, they did what they did back in the, when they were growing up stuff, you know, they weren't very... cool. I say my dad bought records, but that book as far as it went, really. I absolutely couldn't believe what I was doing when I chose to do what I was doing. And certainly never, I never showed any sort of real urge to go into it, certain musical things. So it was quite a late thing for me when I started sort of DJing, by which time, yeah, we were very different people, I have to say. They're just, you know, I mean, I'm not going to speak back with that past, but I'm not going to speak back, but let's just say they're very Scottish, very stuck in the ways with some things. My mum's still, and she's a bit more open-minded now, let's say. We'll leave it like that. my dad really wasn't very open-minded on many things. You know, let's just leave it like that.
Okay, Al, could you tell, you know, you talked a little bit about your route in getting into being a DJ, but that cannot have been an easy path. And I know that from Ariel, that, you know, all the effort that he had to do in order to even start out was massive. So how difficult was that? And what did you have to do?
Oh, it's a really strange thing with us, because I say when I started, a friend was like a mobile disco doing radio and stuff. So I used to just join him and we did. So I would be around about 17, 18. And we did these parties. And then at the time, it wasn't like now where it's just so difficult now. People, you know, it's all about fashion and stuff. And it just, everyone wants to be a DJ. It wasn't really like that then. So we just, where we lived, and it was in Surrey, and there wasn't loads of people about. Although it's turned out to be quite a hotbed for DJs from that time, for that whole 90s acid house scene. It's turned out quite a lot of people came from around there that did really well. Andrew Weatherall and all on the scene we were on, Rocky D's, all terrible. And that's just a real load of them. I remember we just going by our equipment for a disco. I had lights and everything and all that stuff as well. And these guys used to just say, they had that sort of like an agency within the shop. So they say, oh, do you want to play here, play there? And it just coincided with that time where it sort of exploded. Mm. And suddenly you're just doing these parties and they were really quite cool. And I'd love to say it was really difficult. I did spend maybe a few months on someone's floor when I left home, with, you know, when I eventually sort of left the bank and my mum wasn't happy. So I went, but it was only a few months, you know, and then I just got lucky. A friend of mine just said, let's do a party in this club, which was The Brain. It did really well. I don't know how. I really don't know how. And then suddenly Sean McCluskey, who ran it, said, gave me a more night on a Tuesday. And that just blew up. It was only a small club, as if you remember. It's only a small club. And it was packed. And suddenly, so it was a real quick transition, really, from suddenly just doing a few little things. And I had a sound system before, to doing these clubs, and then a few hundred people turning up. And it was just, yeah, it was really bizarre. And then Sean McCluskey, as a sort of mentor as well, was really good. You know, he ripped me off and he paid me as little as possible, but he opened me up to a lot of people. And then I met Peter at the Brain very quickly as well. So it's all just sort of escalated really quick. So I'd love to say it was really, really difficult, but it wasn't.
I remember I used to go to the Omen in Frankfurt. I used to, because I worked on MTV and we were traveling around Europe all the time. So I used to go practically every weekend to Omen. And it was, you know, you talked about the religious experience that you had with Johnny Cash. The religious experience was like being off my brain, you know, like on E in this club. And it was somehow the combination between the music and personally, it was definitely the combination between the music and the drugs and the atmosphere and everything at that time was an experience that I don't think I'll ever forget. So maybe I can ask both of you of your first experience in that way. I'm not asking whether you took drugs or not, just the first experience of the club or whatever.
I was very clear, even when Smash hits, they tried to snare me because they'd just done Brian Harvey and they went, you know, you're Doreen or a dance group dance. Well, but I said, have you ever taken drugs? I went, of course I have. I'm in a diet from house music. And that was it, end of, right? So I'm not putting myself forward as any kind of, example to kids or anything, you know, I'm in that world. But my introduction was this girl called Raina Victoria Shine, who's no longer with us. And I was in Dubrovnik and I heard Chariots of Fire. And I know that Raina cut her teeth working for Vangelis. So when I ended up in London, she put me up on her floor for a couple of years, actually, until I got my stuff together and she loaned me the equipment I needed. And that's when I learned my chops in production and stuff. But sorry, I've forgotten the core of your question.
It was about the sort of religious experience of going to a club.
Steve Proctor's Promised Land down at Elephant Castle. And she gave me half an E and I decided to take it. And my other mate who was in the band with me rejected it. And I had this fucking Road to Damascus conversion. And that very night, he played Sweet Dreams. He played all sorts of eclectic records. And I could actually physically see the colors, shapes and sound of the music. I swear, I've got this thing, I'll tell Alan, synesthesia has always been in me. I didn't know, but this drug really enhanced it. And I was walking around speaking in tongues and like I had this fucking mad conversion. And I went back and it was about 6 months before I touched it again. But I was evangelizing to all my friends. We need to stick this stuff in the water. It'll stop wars, right? Get it in the water supply. Everyone will just hug each other and stop killing it. And I was like, I was right out there. And so it was brilliant because I sort of made the connection, joined the dots and then got into that scene. And by the time I was going out and hanging out with Al, I was well into that, but that made me want to understand the music. So I was presenting Alan with the kind of music that I was hearing, but my best efforts weren't cutting it until he came in and went, make it more like this, make it more like that. And that's that was just all part of that energy that, you know, you felt, that we felt. That was that time. I don't know if it was swinging around in the atmosphere or something, but there's something else at play here, you know, not just the drug, not just the beat, but I suppose it's as we move through time and we're united on one planet, that's that vibe, that scene. That's what was carrying our hearts forward.
I mean, Al, one of the things about DJing is that you play off an audience as well, don't you? You have to really understand where the audience is at. Can you understand where an audience is at when you're not on drugs and you're playing at that period?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, really. I mean, there will be DJs that say they can and have or did. Most of them be lying, probably. I think... You know, I think it'd be really naive to suggest that, especially with that explosion of the house music scene anyway, and I'm sure it happened bygone scenes as well. You know, you hear about all the blueies and stuff, you know, with the mods and all that sort of thing. So, you know, if anyone said it didn't happen, it would be silly. I mean, I know when I started going out in the sort of 86 or so, like I used to go out, but 86 too, we'd be the house clubs. No, and Acid was out, and that sort of came about 87. I can remember, I watched everyone doing it, and I didn't do it for years, to be honest. And then did one, you know, I didn't do it very often, but, you know, and it was, you know, anyone that's done it will know what it does. It's, you know, I wouldn't suggest going out doing it every weekend now, but it was, you know, I was young, and the whole, it was a whole different outer worldly experience. You know, it was, you know, it really was. I think as the music went on and also people taking them at ease, well, essentially, you know, as Peter says, I'm not going to sit and make out with any saint, you know, anything but it was part of the thing, you know, it was part of the sign that the reason they were there was because it went with the music. So, you know, people got into it without it, obviously, and DJs played without it. Not many that I knew, I'll be honest with you, at that time. Mm. And it was a period in time as well. I mean, I know, I think it changed massively, you know, sort of like mid-90s. But, you know, that sort of, yeah, from that sort of 89 to around about 92, it was, you know, it was, and again, that goes what goes in the world. Whoever knows what goes in them anyway. But, yeah, it was huge, and they were completely linked. And the music changed accordingly as they changed. No, there's no question that that's sort of like 89 to around like 92. There's lots of big pianos and hands there and big string and going like, you know, like that. That and that went with the drugs, obviously. And when it got worse, that music's kind of stopped.
When the cocaine arrived in 92, 93, it started, progressive house started then, and then we ended up in garage, and it was all very, you know, I felt left behind then. I wasn't really into that stuff much.
I have to say there's a downfall as well, because I remember that when my career sort of ended and then the drugs didn't work, you know, to quote the classic line, and then suddenly they enhanced the negative side and it was a real downer. And from then I thought, okay, you know, I've had my period of that can sort of lay in that period. So I do think there's a sort of another side to it. But I want to ask, it was your girlfriend, Al, that introduced you to Peter. That's correct, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
Did she have a purpose in doing that? Because she must have known that Peter was a musician, that he was in a band, in a sort of indie band, had signed to U2's label. Did she have a purpose in introducing you, or was it just a sort of a friendship thing?
Oh, she's always got a bloody purpose, she did. I think at the time, I really was just a case of, you know, she knew Peter, I was with him, I'd never said anything about doing music, but she knew Peter was music, he used to come to my club, and she used to go, so I think she just genuinely thought, oh, it'd be a good idea to get together and just see what happens. I don't know if Peter had conversations with her previously.
They were quite aware of me in the office. Kath was my manager, and I was cutting up bits of paper for a company called Romeike & Curtis, who prepared reports for... from the news for boards of directors and stuff. It was mind-numbingly boring, but it was only a job that people with artistic hands could do. And Kath was running that place, and I thought very well, but she would have known that I was talking about working on records, because one of the other chiefs in there, Paul Greendale, was making records, and he was bringing vinyl in. And so we were talking about how to make records all the time. It was just that obsession. You know, she would have overheard the conversations, and she knew I wasn't... really getting it right or wasn't working. Maybe that went subliminally into her head, but she was the one that invited me down to Al's night. And as I said, it'd been 6 months since I'd done anything, and I went down there and it was heaving. The vibe was fantastic. She says, "Oh, look, I'll introduce you to him and bring him up." So I think once he finished his set, we were at the bar. I was struck by how tall he is, because he's 6'2" or something. I'm 5'8". So I'm like, you know, oh, and so he's trying to, it's like little and large act, you know, at the bar. And just saying, look, I've got this track and I just can't make it sound like the stuff you're playing. And he sort of said, well, I'll come over and check it out. And that was it. Next thing I know, he was around at my little humble studio, I had You're the Best Thing. I was working on You're the Best Thing, but it was really, it was my version of what I was hearing rather than actually the thing. And Alan's going, he play these beats, make it more like this, you know, make the kick drum last for 32 bars. And I said to him, or was it 16? I can't remember. But I said, who's gonna listen to that? It's not gonna work on the radio. He says, not for you, you muppet. It's for other DJs so they can lock on. And that was like, ting, there you go. So that put, we had the, with Alan, we had the sort of club kudos, and with me, the sort of muso, and we just put it together, and that really worked. And initially, Al, you remember, I wasn't going to sing. We were trying to try and get singers in who look, you know, who could front the project. So we were going to do the sort of the sound system thing. You remember? We didn't know what we
were going
to go. We couldn't define it yet. We were sort of, you know, these things, you go through it and you go, well, are we going to get these guest singers in? And then we were working in the studio, and the manager said, Tom Fredericks, I think, said, look, check out Pete's in the verse. And then we switched to Deborah in the chorus, and that works. And that's how best thing happened, because I couldn't reach those heights. And that's just, you know, out of just the physical reality. And then it became a happy accident.
Did you actually have a sort of conversation about what you wanted to do in sort of long term, and also what the band wanted to be? Because I've sort of seen things where it's like, you know, the idea of philosophy, but I sort of never believe in those sort of things, because I think you meet someone and if you go, oh, let's try something. I mean, that's the normal thing. So what was it exactly?
We couldn't even have a name. That's how far ahead we were thinking. We just started getting some gigs, and that's really off that thing. We had to get ourselves a name, because to put on a flyer for gigs, because we hadn't even bothered getting a name for ourselves. That's how far ahead we thought, really. We did some tunes that just kind of evolved naturally.
I mean, in retrospect, if you look from today, Al, you're very club, focused, let's say, in that way, and that's your style. And Pete, you're sort of come from like an indie area, but are definitely more, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but you're more commercial oriented in that way.
So Al calls Doreen, much to my chagrin, he calls Doreen his pop project. And I'm like, I shit, eat and breathe this stuff, you know? I don't call it a project. I don't get up and think, oh, I'll do this project today. I'll go and do a bit of DIY, and then I'll do a bit of pop project. You know, I this is what I do. I just, you know, sing and write, and it comes out. Some of it's stupid, and he calls me out on it being too stupid, and we kind of agree on the ones that are the least stupid, I suppose.
But also, Pete, I think the thing where you just said that thing, it's changed around a lot as well. Like when we did the last album, for example, if anything, I'd say I was trying to be more commercial, whereas Pete said maybe we'd do longer. I was like, no, we need to cut this down. This would be more like radio. So it has, over the years, we've kind of like, you know, come back. Pete's always been clubbing. You've been just as a musician.
And Alan and I are writing more together than sort of like, oh, here, I've done something, let's work on that. It's become really, Make Love Cool Again is probably the one we did from a suggestion Alan made up in my sitting room. We just stopped watching TV. The only night we did watch TV. And we ran down, and within 4 days, we had it actually finished from start to finish. That's the first time we've done that. And it was really exciting because you were just handling it. It was just sort of driving you forward. It was almost writing itself. So, I think, commercial. I'm not the McCartney to his Lennon. Let's put it that way. But what it is like Alan's definitely got his head. You know, he's got his new Field of Dreams, and he's in that kind of slow, cool groove thing. He's got his own show, and I listen to his show still, like I used to listen to his mixtapes, and some of that rubs off on you. But I think it's really good because he. I think we're becoming more united in what we're doing, but we never had a long-term plan, Steve. We just kind of, I suppose we're now just exploring what we're capable of, and we're putting now this stuff into the live set. And, you know, unlike other acts, I know, look, and I'm not criticizing them, but you can just go do the old hits and fine, and just go back and pet your cat. But we're driven by our love for music and what potential we have. And we're putting new songs into the set. And we still believe that we can actually go ahead and get our own tour together, build up more of a following, or get people into us again because people have forgotten us. Or if you're working outside the studio system, it's very, very hard to do, but it's very rewarding, the connection we have with the people who are buying into what we're doing and supporting us. And that's great.
Hey, listener, have you ever thought about starting a podcast? Whatever you love to talk about, we know there are listeners out there who will love to hear it. Start your podcast with Acast and join the world's best podcasters, including Mark Maron, Anna Faris, and over 66,000 other creators. You can get started completely free at acast.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I mean, it's interesting you say that, because there are two sort of two, I mean, I wasn't going to go there in this way, but I think you sort of brought it up. There are artists from a particular era, from the 80s and the 90s, let's say, that will go and just repeat their songs on stage, which is all good and well. I mean, you know, there are artists from the 80s and 90s that I absolutely adore, and I would love to see, even if they're just repeating what they're doing on stage. And there are people that aren't satisfied with actually doing that, and they want to develop, because yeah, they've developed themselves.
That's it.
Over the years.
That's it. And also, I also think, you know, I was going to go to art college, and I know from that, that, and I know from the painters that I'd studied, that whether I'm getting awarded posthumously or not, I'm still exploring creativity in my art, and I'm still doing that with Alan in a partnership, which is becoming more and more fruitful. And we're still exploring that, and it still has so much potential. We're now talking about doing a double concept album, and it's just right out there, and I absolutely love that. You know, that it's something to look forward to. It gets me out of the bed in the morning, you know, and it is, sort of, you're learning and growing as well as doing something I think fruitful and worthy.
I don't think there'd be any point doing it if we were just going to do what you said there, just churn out the old stuff. There'd be no point for us doing that. We'd be just phoning me up saying, yeah, we've got another gig here, just going to do the hits, and not bother doing the studio, because the whole point of this is to make new music. You know, we are ultimately a band. I know we're all getting on a bit of stuff and been around, but you know, that's what we do, and that's what we want to do. And we still think, well, we think our last one was the best album ever made, and hopefully the next one will be even better. And that's the way we look at things. So it's just pointless otherwise. I wouldn't want to be just getting up and just going to a gig and just doing things to look better. You're the best thing. And the other ones that people forget about.
How do you deal with the outside perspective on you? Because I've had that, because I was on, you know, being on MTV, and it was known in Europe. So in Germany, where I live, I'm still known, and people will say MTV, and MTV was 30 fucking years ago. Do you know what I mean? And it's bizarre to me to be, even though I have no problem with it, it's my past, but it's sort of bizarre not to think that I may have developed in between. And I'm a screenwriter today, as well as doing this. So for me, I have a different life as well. And you've both developed as well over your lives. So how do you feel when you are, and maybe I can ask you independently, associated with an era, which is, I'm associated with an even earlier era, so that's a sort of different thing. But how do you feel about that when you're associated with an era? Is that okay, or is it something that you internally fight against?
I wouldn't fight it. I mean, that's just the way it is, isn't it? I mean, if things get better, it's a huge hit. I mean, I know we had others, but that's how we are defined. You know, it is what it is. I mean, we took a break as well. You know, we did, for whatever reason, we don't need to go into that. But and there was a long break, and so inactivity from us. So you have to build up a following again, ultimately, somehow, and that's, which is difficult. With a lot of bands, some just kept going, and then have that. So it's easy to, yes, you're known for that, but you've got that sort of because we took a break, we will always kind of be known for that, and it's going to take a while. You know, still young enough, hopefully, to make that happen. Going to take a while for it, you know, to be people to sort of notice your new stuff and say, oh, almost forget that. That'd be very difficult.
Well, they won't forget it, because it's a brilliant track. I mean, I think it's not something that you want to forget, is it, really? It's just it's a great track. But all I mean is that identification with something that you did a long time ago, and whether that identification is...
That's everyone. Anyone that has something that's been quite big, regardless of what, you know, if it's an actor or whatever, something big, you'll always be known for that thing. So I think you just got to go with it. And, you know, hopefully people's perception will not change, because we will be that band that had things a bit better in the 90s. You know, it's just, that's just the way it is. It doesn't bother me. I don't know what Peter...
Well, what I understand about people is that they're very, very small and short attention spans. And to get hold of them for even a microsecond as an artist, it's a blessing. And in that regard, they sort of, you know... In Ireland, what I do, and I had Alan the other night say to me, things can only get better. When they say it to my face, I make them put a pound in the swear box. So, it's swelling, let's put it that way. But I was in Ireland about 2 weeks, and I'd already earned 20 punts from getting people to put, not punts, it was 20 euros from saying that.
Did you say 20 pints?
No, 20 punts should be the previous currency before it switched to euros. Just to say, look, it is what it is. And then the other thing is, some people only experience us through supporting Labour, and then other people are hearing of us through some of the other cover versions that are done, and we're almost being reintroduced to various scenes. So how people experience you is, you know, that's their experience, and they can only acknowledge that to you from their experience. And that, you know, because of the hype of a main studio system, and you're on the TV and you're all prevalent, you know, that defines a song or soundtrack to their lives at that time. And that's what it becomes. Now, that's a great, although it can be a burden in one regard, and the other, it's a calling card. It's a blessing. So it gets us out there, gets us known, gives us a chance to do our new stuff, and gives us a chance, hopefully, to do our own tour at some point, which is where that would be, you know. And I was on my way to the States, and I stopped in London, you know. I wanted to go to the States, and we've never really done anything out there. So, you know, I believe we've got some sort of cult status out there. So it would be nice to go and get a couple of gigs, even if it's just Alan running the backing tracks or DJing with me and doing a live mic. I don't care, but I'd love to get out there. So it's an ambition and hope. And that's a killer hope. But...
yeah, they have.
This morning I was listening to an early instrumental version of Things Can Only Get Better on YouTube. How did that track actually develop from that to the final version? What were the stages within that development?
It was a beast. Do you remember, Alan, we couldn't get it right for so long?
I think that's because it was instrumental initially, wasn't it? And you had your song idea.
Yeah.
You were sort of
trying to each other, but it was like putting square pegs in round holes for a long time. It was a beast, because I had this site, I worked on this song, I had a project, I had a band. he's got me speaking the language. I was in a band with a guy called Jamie Petrie, and we were called Jordan, and we wrote that song, Things Go Better. He came up to me with the lines, "Walk my path, wear my shoes," and it was very much like a Sympathy for the Devil thing. You can wear my shoes, better talk like that, right? So it had that vibe, and it was totally different. And then, what can I say? You know, that didn't work out. But when I was working with Al, maybe before I was working with Al, I can't remember, but I was working with Jamie still, and we never had the chorus for it. And I was sitting in the office, and this girl sitting in front of me was Roland Gift's sister, a girl called Rana Gift. And this is about a year after we started this song, and someone said something very hurtful to me in the office. So I sort of, she could see the tear in my eye, and she says, "Cheer up, Pete. You know what they say, things can only get better." So being a songwriter, I was like, I just left her presence immediately. Went, I had a Sony Walkman with the old cassette in there, and sang this idea thing. I just came into my head from what she said, and so hopefully she won't come after me for royalties, but anyway, that's another story. And then I took that to Jamie that weekend, and we had this song. I was like, fuck, that's really good, you know, and everyone loved it. But you're not in the major studio system, you haven't got a platform. So fast forward 2 years later, Jamie and I aren't working. He has a son, and so he's got to leave to concentrate on that. and I'm going to the clubs and what have you. And it's always been there sitting in the background. But when I got started working with Al, we were working on Best Thing first. And then I knew I kept playing this thing to him. But we were sitting, I don't know, actually, we were sitting working on the Shaw Twins. I never even thought of
things. It was with John Baby June. We'd done the remix for Baby June right. With all the brass.
Okay, all the brass. And then weren't we working on the Shaw Twins? And we had
Shaw Twins we'd done. We'd finished and that became Unforgiven.
Right. And then we had Peter Meyer sort of yellow style thing going on for the Shaw Twins remix. And I stood up and I just started singing that chorus. And you were going, what the fuck is that? And I was going, what's this old song I had for, just came into my head, worked over the backing track. So that became the beginning of it. We knew we had the chorus. But the other bits of writing that were a bit like the Rolling Stones weren't working at all, because that was like the verse. So I moved that into the bridge. And I wrote the verse with Brian Cox one night coming home from Renaissance up in Manchester. And the reason why the gaps are so huge, because I, then nothing, sometimes lose. That gap is the length of time it takes the car to travel from one light in the motorway to the next. Right? So I can't see anything sometimes. Right? So, and then when I brought that down to Al, we were going to the studios trying to make it fit. But the worst bit we had was we couldn't get the chorus to work. And so we were in constantly with backing singers trying to build up this chorus. And every session that we had with various singers just wasn't working. And then one day, Tom Fredericks, our producer, sat us down in the control room and he pulled up a fader from the first session at the EMI studios, the session from the second. And he pulled up all these faders. So there must've been about 40, 50 voices on there. And when we got to the chorus, it was like, that's it. That's the sound. I didn't know we needed a gospel choir. We didn't know. We got there by accident more than design. And that's why when it's on the one, you know, at the opening of the chorus, it punches you in the face and jumps you out of your skin. That was just literally to try and make people, you know, punch the air in E-friendly happiness. And it has all in that.
Always goes back to ecstasy, doesn't it, Peter?
Well, it's that. But listen, every scene has a pill, a beat, you know, a look. It's that. And we were in there and you could not but write for it. You had to be feeling that vibe to put that into the record. And that's all it is. It's a concentration of, you know, Love Ranch. It's a concentration of Renaissance. It's all those, that energy and that scene.
Is it true that the second verse is about Al, or has a sort of meant, because I wrote it out. Sometimes lose myself in me, I lose track of time and I can't see the wood for the trees. You set them alight, burn the bridges of you gone. I'm too weak to fight you. I've got my personal hell to deal with. And then you say, walk my path, wear my shoes, talk like that, I'll be an angel. It's because I think Al in The Guardian, when I read that you said that you'd never realised that that was about you.
You tell me once, you'd written the first couple of lines of that verse about me, yes. Once, yeah. Coming out. Now, it might have been all pilled up again, getting all lovely with me.
When you're working and you're in the old rock scene, everyone's blinkering and it's like, you know, it's my idea, it's my, all this kind of stuff. So you're very, very protective over what you're doing and it's beer and fighting and that stuff. But when you get to work with someone, you're opening out and Al had none of those prejudices I found from my bandmates. So it's kind of, you know, when I'm really blinkered, you're sort of going, let's look here and let's look here. So it was like, yeah, it was a bit of like opening up your heart and your mind. And that's good. I put a bit of that. So there's definitely a bit of Al's influence in there. Yeah.
So how did you feel when you found that out? Because you found it out once you'd split at that point, didn't you?
I was going to feel quite nice. But then I think, as you said, it's probably quite a lot more than just me, but the other people. But yeah, of course it is. It's nothing. It's quite nice to hear that. You think, well, you've that. But if you hear it on the radio, and you think, oh, that's all right, isn't it? That's okay. I like it. It's just brought a tear to my eye.
You just write about what you know.
Yeah.
And you're trying to sort of, I don't know what I'm trying to express. With a lot of the songs that we work on, we're looking for sort of something that is, we're looking for the pop. We do sexy stuff, we do stuff that can be critical, but in the main, we're trying to entertain people and also we're trying to make people feel up. We're not constantly happy clappers here, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, want something that's just got that little bit more to it, you know? And that's, yeah, I've loved what the guy who wrote Superstar DJs Here We Come, he said there's something, what he called, vaguely profound. I love that, you know, because he's not a quasi-religious, possibly, because I grew up a Catholic. But, and then you watch Bono, and half of his stuff sounds like a sermon, you know? So you got this sort of line you've got to tread between, you know, not being too specific and trying to express something. And without just going, you know, hey, we're all going to hell in a handcart, but, you know, I've been saved by Jesus. It's not that. It was that our scene, and, you know, Alan's influence on me is in there as everyone's all along the way. In fact, we wrote Many Hands very, very much about that very same thing.
Maybe it's a little bit of Catholic guilt in there, like I've got as a Roman Catholic, yeah, or I was brought up.
Boy George says he loves having sex with Catholics because they believe it's dirty.
Yeah, I'm with him on that. Yeah. All I can say, I don't know if I should share that. Anyhow, when you did split, how did you both feel in that period about, because you'd achieved such a lot, but I just wondered how difficult that was for both of you. So Al, maybe you can start.
For me, it was my decision ultimately, because we'd moved to a point, and it was just it wasn't going anywhere. It was just it sort of stalled a bit because of management and record companies and this. And I wanted to do things, and I was still DJing and stuff and going out. But you know, making music's the great part of it. You make the music, and then suddenly there's this big machine that's still got this. Someone that you don't know, you can't see, are telling you that you're not allowed to do it anymore because you've got to keep on promoting this or doing this. I just wanted to make new records. And we were stuck in a, you know, doing videos and doing, and it just wasn't going. I think our manager at the time, or Pete's manager at the time, not letting us do remix or anything. And I was just like, this is just pointless for me. So I just had to go and get on with other stuff. And obviously people have a different perspective because he got really busy, you know, so busy with gigs and stuff. I was busy in my thing, but I couldn't, you know, I could have sat there and I don't know how people tell you when he next made a record. I don't know when he next got in the studio. It would have been a while, I would assume. But
yeah.
And you were also being busy being a DJ, I presume.
That's what I was doing, you know, and I was playing most nights. That's the thing. So, like, it's like just, which I would have done anyway, but I wanted to do music. It just seemed pointless to me to stay in that retirement where you'd be taken out of what I was doing to sit around. I mean, I remember when I'd sitting in a studio doing a video, just literally sitting there twiddling my thumbs. And it's just like, well, what am I doing here? This is pointless. So I don't, it was, that, and that was the reason. It wasn't that we'd fallen out or had a massive, but it was just the case that I was bored. And that'd be the truth of it. And then Pete, you know, he'd tell you.
We didn't know what it was. We still, even when we went so fast, that our relationship wasn't defined, and Alan not being a musician and also DJing out a lot meant that we were already divided. So my attention was on like just getting it out there, getting it happening. And my idea is like, it should be on the radio. It should be on Top of the Pops. Alan's like, no, look, I'm busy and I don't get it. And you're going a bit too, you know, you're cutting it down too much for radio and what have you. So yeah, it was a natural split, but it was really along musical lines. And there's a power structure there. Alan had his Catholics managing him and wanted to get him busy with the thing. And there's a clash between Alan's manager and my manager. And we shouldn't have had two managers. If we were a real united group, we would have been doing this together. And we weren't welded together like that. We've become like that now, but back then we weren't. And we were just too busy sort of pursuing our own goals. And and that's why it split. But I have to say, in the intervening years, I really didn't do much on Dream apart from the election. And yeah, it was interesting because all the bands that, all the things that I tried out, bands and different names of groups and stuff, I just didn't do any Dream stuff. I didn't go out touring or I just didn't want to go near Dream. I wanted to try and explore new stuff creatively. So I spent those years building up quite a cache of work, some of which were included on In Memory Of, when Alan heard those. And so I spent a long time understanding, because my ego was such that it was all me, you know. But when I met him in the park, he said, no, you're wrong. I thought it was me. That's me. And he said, well, we should make another record. And we did it. And I realized that I was looking into it. And when I saw what happened to Smiths once Morrissey had split out, I realized that what Marr brought to it. I mean, you see what Sting sounded like when you removed the other two, and even David Sylvian without, it just shows you what happens to bands. And I think that's what I like about them, and is that what they used to call it, chemistry. And I used to deny that it was chemistry, but because I just thought it can't be that, but it is. It's something we can't even define. It's whatever the vibe is, what your respect is for someone. Because I've sat down with other DJs and tried to make records, and none of them work. They just don't. Even David Morales, it didn't work. But when I sit down with Alan, something happens to us and the way we communicate and how we choose and where we, that does work. And so being allowed to have another crack at it creatively was, I just think it's unique. And what can I say? It's just one of those, it's a fate. They call it fate, I think.
You're stuck with each other.
Al, you know, you're doing Field of Dreams, DJing, sort of club runner. You've got these other projects, if I can say that word, going on. You've got these other things going on. So for you, have you reached a point in your life where the sort of sides of you are being fulfilled in such a way that you can do this? Do you see what I mean? It's like, I don't mean to say that there's anything, you know, wrong. I think it's just brilliant that you're back together and doing this.
It's just my life's one project, you know. It's not like Pete Doreen's a project. James, you know, intrinsically linked to my life, you know. So it's it's like everyone, like, you know, you do, Pete, who writes his songs, if not everyone's going to come to us because he writes so much. Dreams are my main focus, really, on like music style of things. The Field of Dreams things just comes and goes when, you know, we're doing it. Let's be honest, unless you're right at the top end, it's hardly a career. I certainly don't want to be recommended to my kids. You know, it's not something that, you know, makes a lot of money. We get gigs now purely because of the fact that we're quite a big band. You know, it's not, you've got to really work at music. So, I've always been fulfilled, to be honest. You just go for it. Dream's my main musical thing. When we didn't do it, obviously it wasn't. Now we do, it is. So, and it's not, I don't have any urge. Even with the dance music I make, I don't really make proper dance music, I always think. My, you know, dance music is for making people dance, and most of the stuff I make doesn't really make people dance. And that's not because it's crap. It's just because I don't have this urge to make real big banging dance tunes. So I don't, and I think that's why Dream works now as well, because I've got, it works because we work together, but yeah, the stuff I have in my head, I pretty much filter it all into Dream. There's not much, I mean, really, really weird stuff, I suppose, at that point it would get released anyway, just sits here looking at it, thinking, yeah. But no, I've always been fulfilled. Music's music, you know, and everything I like would be put into Dream. You know, and if it works, it works. Like Lightwise and Peter, everything he likes. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. You know, he would be quite happy to tell me, like, I'll tell him that's shit. So, no, and that's the way it goes. So it's just, yeah, yeah. Look, Dream's got a bigger platform. I think it has, anyway. I could be wrong, for getting music out there because of who we are, as opposed to my thing here. Yeah, a few things have done okay, but, you know, Dream's a much bigger platform. So you want to put your best stuff with the biggest platform. Well, I think that would be the way anyway.
Has distance and age changed you, Pete, in those terms?
As I said to Pete, you really wouldn't have liked me years ago because I was just very, very self-centered and driven. And I think Brian Cox said it once. He said, I wish Pete wouldn't be so honest because yeah. I was hypercritical of everything, you know, and even myself. So I was a perfectionist and a proper pain in the arse. I would say I've dropped a few scales on the pain in the arse scale, but not totally dropped off it altogether. But yeah, I've matured and I'm definitely more, what's the word for it? Well, mature, with maturity, I'm more wise in what it is we're doing. And also I'm not expecting to be number one in America anytime. I think there's so much potential here that it still excites me. Yeah, we're still dreaming of that, you know. And as I say, I'm sitting watching movies and I'm going, God, what I could do with the budget, you know, in terms of videos and what have you. And so we're looking at, it's not a musical, this concept as such, but we've got an idea of going forward of something really interesting. Maybe Dream the Musical, I don't know.
I'm warming to it now, the Dream the Musical. When I first said it, I thought, that'll be me off again.
Alan's reaction to everything I say for the first time. Watch.
Who's going to play Tony Blair?
Oh, God, who could play? I tell you, he's really good. What's your man there? He did Laurel and Hardy. You remember? Steve Coogan. He could do a good Blair. No, he's brilliant. So, yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, it's something to think about. Because I was... One of my neighbors is an impresario, and he's the guy, Jonathan, I think his name is. He discovered Hamilton, the guy who wrote that, and that's his biggest running thing in the States. And I was saying, have you ever thought about a house musical based on the scenes? come and see me. So I'm still good at that. I might, you know, we'll see when we've got something tangible. We've got the music, but we haven't got, I'm not good at script writing and stuff like that. So I was thinking, what could it be? And then I was thinking, maybe I'll do up some cartoons, not as in sort of stupid cartoons, but more like a 2000 AD where it's more realistic cartoons, the kind of stuff you see played out at the end of The Mandalorian, for example. Those really, really good, you know, beautiful drawings and paintings. And maybe we'll do it like that with a loose bit of a script to it, so that it at least gets it put down. But that's so the musicality matched to the visuals, if you know what I mean, in a way that's
so we're doing. So get this right, we're doing a magazine and we're doing a cartoon now as well. This is all new to me. I heard about the music, yeah. A cartoon, right? Okay, we're doing a 2000 DVD cartoon now as well. Brilliant.
It'll all make sense.
I love the way Pete's brain works. And when he said that Brian Cox had said to him that, Pete, you're too honest. You're too honest. And that comes from a scientist, which is basically truth is what they're looking for, which is brilliant. Yeah. Well, listen, guys, I just want to say at the end, it's been a pleasure to talk to you both. And I'm really pleased that, you know, that you are at this point in your lives, and I do think you really need to accept the fact that you did make a great contribution to, you know, enhancing our popular culture. So congratulations on that, because I know sometimes people go, oh, don't say that, you know, that's, I don't want to hear that, but it's truth. And the thing is, it is a worthy contribution, and really thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
and join me each Monday for a new interview.
Acast is the home of podcasting. No matter if you're brand new to podcasting or a seasoned pro, we've got the best tools to create, grow, and make money from your show. Unlock your podcast's full potential with Acast. Join for free at acast.com.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know, sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.